Welcome to the Book a Week podcast, jointly hosted by the SEPT University Library and the Center for Research on Architecture and Urbanism.
Hello everyone, I am Samini Raja, alumna of SEPT University, currently head of the department at Avni Institute of Design and also serve as director of research at Studio Commune, Kerala. Today, it is an honor to have with us Professor Kazi Khalid Ashraf. Professor Kazi is an architect, urbanist, architectural historian, director general of Bengal Institute of Architecture, Landscape and Settlements. He works at the intersection of architecture, landscape and city and has authored several books and essays on architecture in Bangladesh and India, the works of Louis Kahn and the city of Dhaka. Ashraf has taught at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, University of Pennsylvania, Temple University and Pratt Institute in the USA and lectured widely internationally. He is the author of numerous publications, including this beautiful book under discussion in this episode, The Great Padma, the epic river that made Bengal Delta. I'm deeply moved by the depth of research and attitude towards building scholarship that the book offers. The flux of the river is captured beautifully through the maps, photographs, and essays, which really and truly speaks to the readers. It's a must read for students of architecture, planning, urban design, and landscape. So with that, I welcome you, Professor Kazi Khalid Ashraf, to this podcast series. It's a pleasure to have you here. And it was quite a very, very interesting travel that one had while reading this book in the past 1 month. Interestingly, I took time every day to read bits of what you and your colleagues had written. So it was literally like traveling through Padma every day. So there have been several attempts in the past to document rivers, especially Ganges. So why a book on Padma now?
Right. Thank you so many for inviting me to this conversation. I believe that you have a regular session talking about books, and that's just wonderful. Because one can say that if we have receded from a discourse on books, you know, so I think a book on the river is like sort of another extreme on regarding the kind of topics that we as architects have to work with. Well, your question. Why a book on the Padma? It's precisely because there are so many books on the Ganges. If you look at the publications on the Ganges or Ganga, almost every other year there is a book by a geographer or a journalist or a historian, photographic book or book of essays or interpretive or historical books. But I think one thing I realized that in most books, it kind of, as it nears the end of the Ganges, as I call it, something happens, you know, it kind of peters away. The whole dramatic transformation of the Ganges, which becomes the Bengal Delta, is not really deeply investigated. That's number one. And number two, the Ganga at its termination is discussed, but as Hubli Bhagirathi, which I argue in the book is a channel of the Ganges, but the main bulk of the water of the Ganges flow through the Padma. So the Padma is the Ganges. Padma is not a channel of the Ganges. It is the primary flow of the Ganges. So what struck me as interesting, and I discussed that in my book, this sort of, you know, in almost a marginalization of the Padma in scholarly discourse, is perhaps part of a larger political geography and historical imagination. So that led me to really concentrate on that part of the Ganges, which is the Padma, whose stories need to be told.
It's very interesting the way this book is actually structured. And often one, as you rightly said, when one reads through books on various rivers, you wonder, how do we read a river? Because most importantly, I think, as architects, as planners, landscape architects, how do we draw or represent a river? And in this particular book, it uses several forms of maps, be it historical, satellite imageries. There are also cartographic representations of water that have been, you know, challenged in the past by various authors, especially Dacuna and Anuradha Mathur, where, you know, there's a representation of degrees of wetness using transects are heavily used. How did you choose your tools to represent Padma and her vivid life transformations?
Right, a very important question. You know, in the preface of the book, Amitav Ghosh mentions that the Padma has many avatars, which means it has many faces, many characters, many lives, many histories, many geographies. So in that multitude, which one would you adopt as primary or even a sequence of conditions through which you want to convey the river? Or would you like to show everything? I kind of fell in the latter part, you know, a more comprehensive view of the river. So I did not quite particularize representation through drawings of the rivers, which as architects or landscape architects or geographers interested in the challenge of representing rivers or waters, as Anuradha Mathur and Dilip, good friends, have conveyed to us. I don't think cartography was one primary aspect by which we looked at the Padma. It was to convey the avatars. We did what we have in the book are many historical maps. And in one way or another, we don't convey any priority for them or privilege for them. It's just a historical collection of how the end of the Ganges and how in different periods, rivers or the mouth of the Ganges was represented. So it's a historical documentation. That's number one. Number two, I think most of the descriptions, and I relied on that. And I must say that I receded being an architect in this book. I'm interested in the river imaginary rather than the river representation. And the imaginary works out in multiple ways, mostly through literary descriptions. And what the book has is actually primarily mostly literary descriptions. By that, I mean that how the river or the waters was seen and described or interpreted by various people from 8th century poets to James Rennell and everybody in between. We just wanted to assemble all the literary descriptions of the river. So I think if you ask me if there is a kind of priority, that was that. And of course, you know, we gathered investigations by geographers in Bangladesh and abroad and their speculations of what the continent and what that region was like some 10 or 15,000 years ago. The other thing is that, you know, you mentioned, going to the representation of waters, and especially in turbulent places like the Bengal Delta, at the end of the day, we look at maps, and maps are not enough. Maps are incomplete representation of any kind of aquatic condition, and especially deltaic conditions, which we learned from Dilip and Anu. And you mentioned that, you know, a gradient of wetness. That's true. But the gradient of wetness is a temporary thing. You know, you make a sectional representation, but in a few months, it has completely changed. Next year, it's completely changed. So, you know, what do you do? You can compile maps after maps after maps. It's like mind-boggling. So the representation of deltaic waters continue to be a challenge, you know, at least cartographically. But what we do is actually, at least in maps and our visual representation of the river, we looked at satellite images and also aerial views, drone and things like that. And then the river at the human level, at the ground level. So we moved back and forth in that vertical, if you call, I would like to call it a vertical transect, then a horizontal transect. And things then give different kind of information at those scalar changes. But I must say also, Somini, that the delta is all wetness. That's for sure. That's for sure. It's all wetness. But there is a flux. I was more interested in flux than gradient. By that, I mean, the rivers in the delta are furious phenomenon. And they become more furious in monsoon and right after that. I kind of focused also not just on the water, but what the water carries, silt and sediment. You know, that's a story that has not been told, because the delta, the formation of the delta, the sort of the geometry of the delta, and the chemistry of the delta is about the water and the silt and their complex relationships.
Thank you. And related to what you just mentioned, you know, like the river itself, the book sort of expands and contracts in its form. There are long essays, especially the one that you wrote. And then there are these brilliant photo essays, poetry, and so on and so forth, which sort of makes it a rich experience for a reader. And also the kind of narrative that you're building of Padma, it sort of straddles its sacred beginning, where you acknowledge the mythology behind Ganga, Ganges, Bhagirathi. And then, as you mentioned earlier, the canal-like form, the sociocultural politics of it. And then the rich deltaic mouth, which is pregnant with, you know, copious life forms. As an editor, how did you decide on the form of this book and narrative of not just one river, actually, it's rivers. How did you decide on this form?
I think the decision happened as we kind of moved along the river, when we picked up the topic itself. You know, I think at the Bengal Institute, we were looking at the mapping the delta, which, is, as I said, is a complex and challenging task. You know, we have geographers in our team, and they were looking at the coastal Bangladesh, which again is a kind of sort of, you know, related to the Padma, because it's the water of the Ganges / Padma, which flows down to the south, to the coast, and along the way, we've seen the delta. So our team has been working on that for a number of years, and that eventually led to, and we thought that we should work on a book. So, and I think the answer for this question relates to your earlier question also, because if the river has many avatars, it has to be described or understood by many voices. There are some books in Bengali on the river. Some more either technical or like sheer description, but to give the full comprehension of the river and its full complexity, at least as an editor, I can say I tried to understand the full complexity and to engage that full complexity where I went out and invited people to kind of write on this or that. So yes, many voices and then many scales, which I mentioned before, you will see photographs. We organize the photographs with albums. It starts from the sort of the aerial or godly view, if you like, to the geographic view, going closer and then moving along the river and then life along the rivers. So I thought photographs were very important tools for us. And of course, you know, the texts are of all kinds, small to long. The book, I think, will cater to multiple interests. If anybody wants to have a sense of the Padma by looking at the photographs and the maps, they will. If they kind of zoom in on one particular article of any topic, they can. If they want to know about a particular kind of food that is made by boatmen, which was then picked up by colonial English people and then became a kind of cuisine of East Bengal, they can do that. So the book moves in multiple directions. My job as an editor was try to kind of first let it overflow, which is the term I use. I don't use the word flood anymore, overflow, and then contain it. So it's up to the readers and maybe up to you, Soumini, to decide whether it has been contained well or let it overflow.
Thank you. It was quite a joy to experience the overflow of the river in the past 1 month. So thank you for that. I also want to highlight here that many of the essays that got featured in this book, it throws light on the changing ecology and the morphology of the river, especially for a river like Padma. The morphology is so very important. And there's a particular section in the book which sort of dedicates, which is dedicated fully to the urban landscapes along the river. So it's just a general discussion. I thought I should raise this question here. What does it really mean to look at urban history through the lens of a river? And what does this perspective offer to urban planning discourse?
Absolutely important question and topic for me. I mean, that's where I, as an architect, perhaps it's relevant in doing a book on the rivers in Bengal, because I realized, I would say some 20 years ago, that, you know, if you want to think about architecture and, but more precisely, cities and settlements in the Bengal Delta, an understanding of rivers, their flows, their dynamics, and what I just mentioned, overflow, should be carefully understood, especially in the organization of settlements and what we call urban planning. The urban planning practice in place today in Bangladesh, unfortunately, I don't see that prioritization of the water dynamics. And I think it should be number one. Anybody working with urban planning, even urban design, even if you think that, okay, here is, you know, I'm looking at my left, you know, it's a beautiful field there, public field. And one assumes or one has a kind of feeling that this will stay static and dry and exactly like this. But it's a myth. In Bengal, anything can happen. You know, I'm sure there are some constructed dryness that can stay dry, but the sort of back and forth between wet and dry and various kind of wetness is a fluctuating thing. You know, humans try to manage it and keep it fixed, but fixity is not assured. So urban planning discourse, urban planning methods and practices have to prioritize the dynamics of water, and which then led me personally an interest in, I need to understand the rivers of Bengal if I want to perform as an urban designer or urban thinker. And that has been a kind of obsession for me. And that may have led to looking at the history and the narrative of rivers, right? And then there are specifics we discovered while looking at the history of the Padma. And we were curious, you know, of the nature of settlements along the Padma. Unlike Hugli Bhagirathi, where settlements have been more static, I would say. By settlements, I mean from villages to towns to major cities. You know, I lump everything under settlements. But along the Padma, you know, so many hundreds of villages have just vanished, you know, and nameless villages, and they are not documented, you know. So can you imagine for, say, a couple of thousands of years when this region became more populated, the amount of destruction that has happened, and the villages that have just gone down under, you know, into the waters. But in that sort of anonymous landscape of destruction, there are few that pops out. Rajnagar is one of them, which was sort of south of Dhaka. And in the south of Dhaka, the Padma River has been shifting back and forth. So once upon a time, the Padma is farther south, and north of the river was Rajnagar. And nothing exists. We don't even know where Rajnagar is. The river has shifted, silting has happened. Now it's, you go now, it's a kind of, you know, a new township and villages and all that. It's quite amazing. It has just totally vanished. It's like Atlantis. But we know from evidence, drawings by colonial artists, you know, magnificent temples, buildings, magnificent meaning very magnificent, kind of temples that you don't find in India, like seven tall spires, you know, a series of temples. Even James Rennell, that cartographer who gave cartography to India and Bengal, while traveling during his great voyage along the rivers, he encountered Rajnagar and he described it from a distance. But just a few years after that, there was a great sort of shift in the river and Rajnagar was completely obliterated. So that's one aspect, you know, the sort of destruction of settlements along with human lives and human culture. And for that reason, Padma has a nickname, which is mentioned in the book, Kirti Nasha, you know, the destroyer of human achievements. So what we did in the book is one section, we looked at selected settlements along the Padma, which now exists from kind of the border of Bangladesh and India, which, you know, very strangely, that's where Padma, starts. So that's a lot of historical background to that. So I think we looked at 14 selected settlements from very close to the India-Bangladesh border, to the city of Gaur, which was an important Sultan period city, to all the way down to the coast settlement in the coastal area. So, and we just documented, you know, lives, buildings, human activities, to kind of see if in this panorama of 14 cities, we can understand how people have lived their lives in urban contexts.
Interestingly, as you were rightly mentioning, there is this fluctuating landscapes, but there's also this critics and the terror of Padma that people speak about, people, you know, sing about. One can also see and feel them through the photographs and most of the writings. What alternate meanings do these ebbs and flows offer to the people of Bengal? I'm asking this specifically because we are today largely affected by human-induced climate change. And in these shifts that Padma is otherwise going through and which could be exacerbated by the climate change, what are those alternate meanings that this offers to the people who are living by?
That's a good question. In fact, I would like to find out more about that. You know, I mean, one can do a survey and one can speculate, you know, what alternative meaning people have along the Padma. But without really working with the people, you know, it's difficult to assess that unless, you know, you looked at existing documents, you know, stories, songs, poems, or other kind of technical documents. Of course, living with the Padma, as well as other rivers in the Delta, which behave similarly, flux in the flow and overflow, erosion and accretion, pretty dynamic situation. And people have lived with that for thousands of years. You know, I'll admit I don't live like that. You know, I live in a very dry condition. You know, I can only observe and speculate. But people in that part region, their lives have been intertwined with that complex condition. Maybe one should be careful about theorizing this, you know, whether the resilience of the people of Bengal is derived from there or not, but surely resilient people, inventive also, innovative. You know, the destructions happen, but they have been inventive in reconstructing their lives, you know, and that's an aspect of living with rivers of such flux and overflow. Now, the conditions by which global climate change effects are described today were always felt in parts of Bengal, regularly, seasonally, you know. So, but what has happened is now they have been, now been conflated into the narrative of climate change, right? And I think what it means, you know, the politics of the narrative of climate change is involved here. What I'm saying is that how climate change narratives describe human conditions have been happening before climate change becomes an issue, which is not to say that new devastations or conditions are not happening, but one needs to care for riverine dynamics of Bengal and what is really global climate change. But in the string that connects the two are the resilience of the people and their inventiveness.
Another area that I thought probably one did not quite write a lot on was how to read the architecture of Bengal through the narrative of Pada. Is it Pada? Pada? I don't know the correct pronunciation of the term. But because there's so much written on the river itself, but there's only a hint of its influence on architecture of the region. So how do we read architecture of Bengal through the narrative of Pada?
Well, it's Padma, as we may say in Sanskrit or in anglicized form. In Bangla, it's Padma. So in the book, in my own essay, I go back and forth between the two. And we wanted to give the book a title, Padda. But then we realized, you know, there's nothing on the internet, Padda, or very rare. It's Padma. And then we have a problem. We also discovered a problem also, you know. So Padma, and then you search Padma, you find Padma Lakshmi, you know. So completely Padma Lakshmi for internet attention. Anyway, architecture, you know, so how does the architecture of the region relates to the Padma, if that's what your question is, and perhaps you're also saying that the attention to architecture is not sufficient, right? Am I right?
Yes, right. Because there are photographs of architecture of some of these towns that emerged along Padma, but there's not much written on it. Probably that's not part of the agenda as well. I'm just curious, was there any narrative to the way architecture evolved through the narrative of Padma?
You know, as I said, you know, in doing this book, I receded being an architect, and I think I was more a historian or a composer for the book. And I tried to assemble various sort of, you know, descriptions by which the river could be understood. Of course, you know, architecture is one of them. But I mentioned earlier, we looked at settlements, you know, and there are maps of the settlements. You know, they have not been analyzed. They are purely visual descriptive maps, and also a kind of documentation of various sort of building types from up stream and all the way down to the estuary. But there's one aspect, Anthony Achiavati, who is a very well-known geographer, landscape architect, writes about, you know, his essays called Himalaya Padma. And he argues, and I say that a little bit in my essay also, that how material condition, objects, things, from upstream Ganges, meaning all the way from, let's say, even farther than Delhi, boulders, stones, human debris fall into the river, gets pulverized, rolled down into the plains of Bengal. Even components are parts of the Himalaya, and which then Achiavati writes that, and then they emerge as landform or chars or sand islands, is the kind of transmutation of the Himalayas in the plains of Bengal. It's what he describes it as an ecological reversal. But then he also very interestingly and even poetically describes how the silt and the sediment also gives you mud, clay, which are then gathered, transformed into bricks, they're transported to main cities, and the whole of Dhaka, this huge, furious city formation, then could be seen as a kind of product of the Padma, not Padma, other rivers also. So not architecture in the way we talk about it, but this whole sort of human development as buildings and cities and settlements are really part and parcel of riverine behavior.
So now you did mention about the settlements that are along Padma. There is also architecture of Bengal through the narrative of Padma. So if you were to write more on Padma or Padar, what would that narrative be?
You know, I'll admit, you know, stories of rivers are always incomplete. As much as we claim this is a comprehensive narrative of the Padma, it's not complete. It's ongoing. Of course, you know, doing the book, we discovered new themes, new topics, new gaps. Perhaps one thing that I would like to work on is, you know, in the book, I mentioned that the river can also be seen as an ecological axis. And so the Ganges at its forking, when it becomes Hubli, Bhagirathi, and Padma, I see as two ecological axes. They're also political axes. By that, I mean the nature of settlements along the two axes and the political history behind those settlements, the economic history behind those settlements in the ecology, which is very important. So I want to kind of look into that ecological political axis, Padma as an ecological political axis. And in a more precise way, I want to look at Bikrampur, or Bikrampur as it was called, which was at the end of the axis, you know, which was a very well-known city in the 12th, 13th, 14th century. And again, Rajnagar was part of it. I'm very interested in that, you know, and to kind of understand that history, understand that part of the history which by which Bengal was connected to, well, you know, of course, you know, we talk about Bengal's connection with Java, Sumatra, Myanmar, but then to China on the one hand, then to Africa, which is incredible.
Wonderful. So I really look forward to reading on Bikrampur soon. And I wish you all the very best with your research and, you know, explorations along Padma. Thank you so much for spending time with us on understanding more about the great Padma book. It has been a great pleasure speaking to you, and also wonderful experience reading this book.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. Do not miss to like, share, and subscribe to our podcast, available on all your favorite podcast apps.